Solano, and I was supposed to be here this morning, but good old Air Canada is always dependent. Let me tell you a little bit, actually, just a couple minutes, just in terms of background. I came from a hard science background, microbiology, immunology, and so I went from studying microbes to studying people, and did an MBA, and actually focused on finance and consumer behavior. When I was looking at consumer behavior, it was all in a very quantitative fashion. You know, all these wonderful predictive models and advanced statistical analysis. And I was telling Maria, having worked in the financial services industry for a number of years, and I had the pleasure of being given millions of dollars to spend. And because large organizations, particularly in the financial services, do that. That's exactly what they do, is in the hope of always increasing sales. And I guess for me, my trigger point where I knew I had to make a shift was, and I was quite young. I was in my early 30s, but I was heading up a marketing research brand strategy group. And when the CEO at the time, who's not a very nice individual, but stared me down and said, "So you've spent all this, you know, millions of dollars, so how predictive are your models?" I said, "Well, do you have," and this is pretty gutsy for somebody who's in their early 30s, and said, "Well, do you have a coin? Toss it." But you know what? He had tremendous respect, because that's when we shifted and basically was a segue into really trying to understand things at a much deeper subconscious level. So what I'm going to do today is introduce you to a model that we've been working with for years. I mean, it's our own model, our own algorithms that we've been constantly developing and modifying and refining. And the excitement of being involved here is that there is the science aspect. So I feel like I'm kind of going 360 degrees is where I've come from the world of trying to understand at a deep subconscious, hard and soft, but now, you know, bringing the physiology and the neurobiology aspect of it. So that's really what excites me. And our company does a lot of work for top 500 Fortune companies. I mean, the P&Gs and the Kimberly-Clarks, GSK, I can go on and on. And as you can imagine, we're always accountable. So what that means is we can't go into a lab and no offense to anyone, but to, you know, do something theoretical. At the end of the day, we have to have proven results in anything that we apply. And what we found over the years is in the approach that we've taken and we've been taking and modifying it and refining it is that we continue to have more and more success. So this is essentially, when I sat a year ago and listening to all this wonderful stuff, and it was in much bigger rooms, I said to Lorette, I said, "Well, you've got a lot of stuff here," but I said, "Where's the modeling of the behaviors truly at, you know, at a much deeper level, so that we can start to get a better sense of how do people, you know, what drives people to have a healthier eating and lifestyle versus people who don't, and also people who have lapses, you know, people who get on the bandwagon of, you know, I'm going to try this healthy diet and lifestyle and fall off." So I'm going to talk a little bit about the approach and then a little bit about what the project is. This is very, very high level. So what our approach is really moving beyond the neuroscience. I mean, what we're trying to understand is what really triggers people to have these healthy eating behaviors. And there's a crisis out there. We all know that. You've heard it over and over. You don't need me to tell you that. But I know with the clients that I work with, even those clients who, you know, I mean, Frederic, you call them food junkie in terms of gourmand. We call food junkie in terms of people who eat fast food. And you know, clients, I mean, not to be completely in their defense, I mean, corporations like the Coca-Colas, I mean, they have moved into healthier types of soft drinks and et cetera. But they're always struggling. I mean, the package, you know, food industry, the fast food service industry is really struggling because when they do try to do something healthy, consumers don't buy it. And so it's not so easy just, you know, shifting a product that is healthier and then ensuring that it does work. I mean, we've been involved in situations where the healthy product just does abysmal. And the taste, you know, quote unquote, it's supposed to be better, but it just doesn't work. So clients get frustrated because, you know, on one hand they try to go there, but they've been burnt, so they don't know where to stand on that. The other thing too is one of the things that we find is that you just, it's not enough just to understand why people do what they do, but it's how do they do it. So what's going on, and not just from an observational perspective in terms of observing them in a store or in their home and seeing what they're doing, but what's going on in their minds, what's going on deeper at a subconscious level. And that was why I asked John the question that I did. And so when he told me he was using a questionnaire survey instrument, I knew that there's no way that you're going to make a connection there, because there's different parts of the brain that the individual is using, and it becomes very cognitive. So of course you're never going to get the true answer there. So our approach is very much understanding the whys and then the hows, because ultimately, I mean, you can study the neuroscience, which I'm really excited about doing that, because I want to, you know, the scientist wants to connect it. But then from a practical aspect, from my client's aspect, is, okay, so we know that, you know, the dopamine levels are, you know, the dopamine receptor levels have increased because, you know, of this particular reward system or whatever, but how do we communicate that reward system? Is how do we deliver that reward system? And that's where language comes in. And the neurolinguistics of it is how do we communicate this? And how do we deliver it? So our approach is not qualitative, it's not quantitative, and from a marketing research method, it's really, and we've coined it an active insights modeling approach, it's very multidisciplinary. I mean, we use psychoanalytics in the interviewing process to dig very, very deep. We also look at social, cultural, behavioral analysis. So when David, I'm sorry, Charles, I missed your presentation, but I was so excited about understanding the senses, because we do look at the senses, but the way that we look at it is I would assume is probably different than the way you would. But that's something that we're also very, very attentive to, is from a cultural perspective what's happening in terms of the sensory modes, but also from an individual perspective what's happening is how much of the cultural stuff is individuated in that individual that we're studying. And we're looking for hidden patterns of verbal and nonverbal cues. And those cues range from, you know, I can have somebody when they're in that mode of trying to understand their individual experiences, shift their whole body language, not just the language, not just the what they're telling me. I mean, I never believe what they're telling me, but it's how they're telling me. So what's the decode, you know, what are the patterns of language in what they're describing? And that's what I try to decode. It's a unique process to understand how successfully, ultimately, our approach is to influence behavior. The first time that we did some work for P&G, they said, oh, we're not in that business. We don't influence, we don't manipulate, we don't. Well, we said, no, when we talk about influencing behavior is if you understand what people want and need truly at a deep level, what you do is just mirror. You can't lead people to do what they don't want to do at a very deep level. You just can't do that. You're not going to make somebody into something that who they are. But part of, I know from a marketing context and looking at a lot of communications and advertising, is that often you're not even communicating what they want. And it's not because you can have the product, but it's how you deliver that product. It's how you communicate that product. And that's where you start to build the safe rapport. So what we do is very in-depth psychoanalytic interviewing to really, really identify those through need states. I mean, we've all seen the iceberg metaphor in so many different ways. And what often, you know, traditional marketing research and survey instruments, consumer survey behavioral instruments look at is really the opinions, the what's the perception. And, I mean, I'd love to get a copy of John's questionnaire, frankly, because, I mean, I'm sure, because having, again, done a lot of quantitative work, that's ultimately where you go, is you ask a lot of rational questions. But when you're going into those in-depth interviewing processes, what we're trying to tap into, and by putting them into that state of their experience. And it's interesting because we've done ethnographies where you can observe people, you can ask them there and then, and they cannot articulate, you know, why they're making their choices, or because they get right into a rational mode. But if you take them out of that environment, and then they have a mental representation and memory of what that experience is. And then when they're going and recollecting, and it gives us a venue of one-on-one, and you're going deeper and deeper, then you get into their belief systems. And those beliefs are really interesting because you get into those emotional beliefs, not just the rational beliefs you get. And we start to look at what are limiting beliefs, what are the permissible beliefs, which beliefs are that we can influence and evolve. We look at their value systems as they're going through that individual situational experience. And what's fascinating to us is that's where the environment and culture then comes in, not just at a collective level, but how they've individualized it. How, you know, what's the individuation process that they're going through? And we're looking also in terms of when they're talking about this, there is an emotional program. Not just the feelings associated with each of those belief systems, but there is an order. There's a pattern. It's fascinating. I mean, we've always, and you look at the risk and reward, the trade-offs, the decision choices that they're making at that in each of those points that they go through in describing that experience. So in the healthy eating, I mean, these are the kinds of things that we'd be looking at in terms of describing, and because one of the things that we're going to talk a little bit later about it is, you know, again, people who have, there's three different populations, those people that have always been eating healthy and having a healthy lifestyle, to the extreme where there's people who've never been able to successfully have a healthy eating, healthy lifestyle. And then there's the people who are, I mean, and there's lots of, you know, we're making it more simplistic here, but there's people who have managed to adopt a healthy eating, healthy lifestyle. And from our context in this research, if people who have been able to do that and have maintained it for 3 years, you know, those are the people we're interested in looking at. Is what happened? What were the triggers? What was going on at all these levels, emotional and instinctual? You know, what's going on at a very, very deep instinctual level? And if you ladder down enough and if people are in that state of mind, it comes out naturally. I mean, it's really interesting because it's all about the rapport that you build. So that's how we get into it, is we really truly use psychoanalytic and neurolinguistic tools to get deep into their psyche. Just how understanding how to influence behavior, as I talked about, decoding these hidden languages is critical. And we've done, I can't even, hundreds of this type of research, is there seems to be, just like, you know, there's a common language in a culture, for some reason, people who have behaved a certain way, so there's cohort behaviors, they have similar linguistic patterns. And it always fascinates us, is that sometimes, you know, in a country, if we take a look at it from country to country, if we take a look at it within cohort behaviors, then even within brands, we see some shifts in the language patterns. That's one of the reasons, for example, I mean, I can't talk about our clients, but Activia, for example, when they came to launch it in the U.S., we were asked to do the research to how to successfully launch it. And we told them, and we went through this process, and they successfully launched it in the U.S., but we also told them, in 2-3 years' time, you're going to have problems. And they're having problems now because of overpromise. They overpromised what it could deliver. So, anyways, without getting into that. So, and the right set of cues. Clients often ask is how come you can build rapport so fast with an individual? Because what I'm doing is I'm attentively listening to that person and I'm decoding their language. I'm decoding their, not just their language, like linguistically, but their body language. And you can't mimic, but you can mirror. And when you mirror, people feel more comfortable. I mean, we've all been in situations where you both speak the same language and you walk away and you scratch your head and say, they didn't understand me. And by just understanding how to decode that language, understand where it's connected to their emotional belief systems, you start to build a rapport and then people feel safe and then everything starts to pour out. The outcome of all of this is, I mean, again, this is very high level, and it's a lot deeper than this. But essentially what comes out is a behavioral model. And what we're looking for are the triggers that, you know, lead to that end behavior, that end state. And there's, you know, there's behaviors, there's decision-making that goes, what are those trade-offs, all of those elements. So think about all of this that I've talked about, and we're incorporating it into a model, a behavioral model, then that, where it becomes, from our client's perspective, from a marketing context, is something that they can take, apply, whether it's in the development of a brand repositioning exercise that we're doing, whether it's new product development where we're looking for white space opportunity, or whether it's on how to communicate your service offer or product offer. And And so we've done tons of these models, but just some of the models there that we've done is on smoking cessation. I was really interested when Antoine was talking about the visceral, because Antoine says, well, you can't have visceral effect. No, but you can use modalities, sensory modalities, which they did, which, well, I can't talk about it, but is they used certain sensory modalities that led to people more effectively stop smoking. Incontinence, you do a lot of work in the financial services, oral care, energy conservation, and soft drinks with food. There is a way of how to portray and how to talk about and even how to show a bottle of Coke. There's a whole, I mean, the work we did is they basically took all of their manuals and they rewrote them all. Just with understanding, and I'm not talking about drastic changes here. I'm talking about very, very small changes that make big differences. So in terms of back to the healthy eating and living, is one of the things that we're looking at, as I said earlier, is we're looking at these three populations. And partly, I wish we could do more, but it's also the economics, I mean, the cost of conducting a project like this. And we're looking at a multicultural project. And what's interesting for us when we do multicultural work is that you start to see some of the, anything that is closer to biology, it's more universal. Anything that's further away from, you know, when you start getting to other parts of the brain, then it's interesting to see the cultural impact and how people have individualized those things. But we'll investigate dietary habits, exercise, activity. We'll look at also life progressions in terms of their timelines, you know, successes and failures, because we need to understand. So within each of these cohort groups is what's the model of success and what's the model of failure? And what are, you know, what's all these criteria, all these variables and elements, and what's the criteria that we need in order to shift those folks? And along all of these and all of these situations, there's a perception also of an ideal self and a current self. I cannot begin to tell you probably the biggest problem that food manufacturers and other industries have is acknowledging and recognizing that there is this tug. There's always this tug of, you know, what society, what culture, what my cohort group thinks that I should be. And so there's this idealization of self. But then who am I right now? And there's this gap. And you can imagine with food what how big an issue that is. We'll look at the role of nurturing, like childhood family dietary beliefs and behaviors, the philosophy. We heard a lot about guilt. And we found, I mean, Antoine called it different somatic states, and we call it tensions, which is, you know, what are the tensions that people are going through when, you know, do I feel, am I going to feel guilty in terms of if I give this to my child and go to get him a happy meal versus giving him a healthy food? And, you know, and it's true. Is if you keep reinforcing, because the risk of not keeping him happy is going to create more of a chaos and havoc, then that individual just, that's where I have been given permission. So that's where they rationalize, is from an emotion, they go through the cognitive and they start rationalizing. And those are the kinds of things that we want to take a look at, is all these different elements. Once we do this, is from our Active Insights Healthy Eating, and I'm sorry, I've broken all the laws of PowerPoint. But, you know, you told me, like, keep it in 10 minutes, so I'm talking fast. And the outcome of the model itself, we can start working with communications, education, programs with government, medical professionals. I mean, we do a lot of healthcare work, and, you know, it's not just about talking to the, and when it's over the counter, the consumer, but it's also the healthcare individuals that are involved, whether it's the doctors, the pharmacists, et cetera, and often these individuals don't even know, they don't even know what they're doing and how they're doing. They know it intellectually, they know it from a competency skill set, but they don't know what's, you know, what they're communicating at a deeper level. Identify unmet need states for product repositioning, develop potential reward mechanisms. This is where I get excited, and I mean, you see there the neurological testing. This is where I get so excited about is the opportunity for us to look at it, doing concept testing work, for example, when we develop the concepts or the programs or whatnot, and then mirroring it to, you know, to from a, and looking at it from a neurological state, not just like in terms of the dopamine levels, but what are the neural pathways that, you know, that are engaged if you communicate something, you know, in A versus B, and what are the fine-tuning? Because then what you really do is you have a marriage where you understand it from a neurobiological aspect, and then we have the diagnostics to actually use how do you want to communicate it. Unfortunately, Chris McCarthy, my strategic partner in Alliance, isn't here, and they're with TNS Landis, and we've worked for over 10 years, is, you know, I can't resist the quant. And I think it's, you know, it's an imprint. When you're imprinted with numbers and scientific theory and testing, is, you know, we take, and they have algorithms, and it's called these matrix model algorithms that we've worked and refined with them over the last 10 years, and have had a lot of success. And so, you know, of course, I pulled in Chris here. And, I mean, I'm not going to talk about that piece of work, but essentially it's taking what we know. And so then the survey instrument becomes a very different survey instrument. I mean, we just did some work with Pfizer on the OTC side. We just finished where we went through that process, and the client says to us, isn't it wonderful when everything just works? You know, like you don't have these disparate types of insights. So that's the healthy eating. What we're hoping for is to move into something that's more well-being and hopefully maybe even a healthy living index, or, you know, we've had conversations. I mean, looking at different kinds of indices. So out of this, all of this work, I'm done. I'm sorry, it's a very high level.
Questions?
You have some, what you said, if one was skeptical of the approach, you could say, if you're an intuitive individual, that was another area where it has a model
you
don't talk about. You can fool people with.
Yeah, absolutely.
What can you point to kind of convince the skeptic? There's more to it than just intuition. The model means something.
Well, I mean, what I've shown here right now is at a very high level. Mm-hmm. So when you're saying the model means something, I mean, essentially what we do then is we go and get it tested. So into whether it's a delivery of a product or a program, and then that's what we test, and then sales is ultimately, you know, how it does in the shelf, given the work that we've done, or how an advertising campaign does when it's post-tested and it's tracked, and looking at, you know, the input that we've done and how it elevates in terms of persuasion, awareness. And so the skeptics become champions.
You have some process of saturation, I believe. You don't do this just on individuals.
It's not on one person.
The number of
It's not. And when we're looking.
To answer the question, if you're an intuitive individual, you can't convince people that your intuition is their model. They have a model. They say, well, this worked, that worked. Like this, what's in your head? You could also do that model. You could go to the companies and say, well, what's your problem? Yeah, well, okay. I recommend this. How do we know that the model has anything more than what intuition might give?
Oh, what intuition might give?
Are there any sort of tests comparing this versus other approaches?
Well, it's because we get down into very, very discrete insights. And so there is a sense of, okay, what's the identity of the individual in terms of how they're making this selection of this product? And then how, you know, in terms of that particular selection of the product is what's going on in their mindset. And once, it often what our clients have always responded to, this is like an aha moment for them. But I think it really becomes something that is powerful for them when it gets tested and they see the results. So when they get when it gets tested and they see that, oh gosh, you know, here's using this technique and approach versus not using it. I mean, we did direct mail programs, for example, is where we said go, you know, leave it as is versus with the input and the insights, and sales went up. So, you know, that's essentially what you do. So right now the model, I mean, I didn't go into all the specifics, details, and et cetera. So it's not just an intuitive model. There's always an aha insight. And that's what gets them connected. And the process always is, it's like a mind map when it starts, because people are trying, it's because you're getting at an emotional level, and people are, you know, when you're looking or studying at a particular product, I mean, they go like this. And then you have to, you know, we start to put order, because the consumer puts order in it. And so then that's when the behavioral model happens, and then, you know, and then there's advertising or sales, you know, programs that are put against that. I'm not sure I've answered your question.
One of the roadmap projects is indeed to do some of this about talking about healthy eating in some way and getting that type of in-depth motivation. In the plans are to do in various countries, including India, potentially UK, Canada, and USA. Bernd Schmidt, we're talking at lunch, we'll be doing one on eating experience. So that's why there was a couple to come to come from today. It would be great in terms of getting to a much more sophisticated understanding of what is needed for transformative innovation, whether it's product design, communication, pricing, and so on. Question?
Who is among your clients, for example, the kind of people that are paying more interest to the process? Marketing people, market research people, science trained people, or just CEO decision makers? Do you see a difference among
the I see a difference. I mean, typically we're not brought in by market researchers. We're brought in by chief marketing officers or chief operating officer or CEO.
Did they challenge
on your approach? No, they don't. I mean, the market research people don't, because at first they're just trying to figure it out and understand it. And it's what's interesting for us is they typically come to us when they've tried so many different things. You know, they've tried the ethnography, they've tried the traditional research methodologies, and they're still not able to make, you know, because the idea always is you know, how can we improve our sales, or how can we improve our marketing communications? What's the white space opportunity that we can find here? So, and it's been off the word of mouth. It's because as they experience it, then people get excited, and then ultimately it's the delivery. We had something happen with GSK, for example. I won't say what the product is, but and this was at the international level. And we used this process, and we were told, no, you can't do this in Japan. I said, why can't we do it in Japan? We've done it in Japan. Oh, no, they don't talk. They don't da-da-da. They don't do any of this stuff. And, well, the sessions ran 3 hours. So that was already something that we broke that, you know, belief that you can't do it because a Japanese man or woman won't talk to you at that length of time. And in a group situation. We had grown men who were in tears because of the subject matter. These are Japanese men. I mean, the head of global innovation, when we had gone through the process and everything came up, and he gave me a big hug because he said, you know what, we proved them wrong. And immediately the campaign and the delivery of the product, I'm not going to get into all that stuff, but is literally in like a few months, they just spiked. We had more challenges in North America. And what I found out actually in January of this year that they told us, now this is a flat line product in terms of their brand, and they had a 5% increase in sales. And that's significant for a brand that is flat line. Mm-hmm. So that's how, and this is how people start to see the importance of it.
Thank you. And then